show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Yet again, we still remain in baseball offseason, and things are going to start heating up here soon. And kind of the first smattering of notable things in the offseason is the awards that start pouring in now as soon as the season is officially over, which we have, and we'll get to those here in a second. But first, of course, I am Jeff Herr, and with me is, as always, is the multi-award-winning Michael Engel, award-winning in our hearts and minds. Mike, how are you doing on this very, yet again, another very fall evening, at least here in Kansas City?
Yeah, when I left the house today to go to work, leaves were literally falling off of a tree, like pouring off of it almost. It was a little surreal. It was so many of them, but it's that time of year. It was been chilly all week, so that's, you know.
Yeah, I have a tree in front of my house. I'm not certain what type of tree it is, but it's not just like a standard oak tree or something. It's got these very like flat, long leaves, you know, not that typical leaf shape that you think of. And it just was like, you woke up one day and we went to the store and they came back and it's just like, boom, my yard is covered in these yellow leaves. And it's just kind of the same deal. Like the tree just panicked. Oh no.
Oh crap, I'm behind.
I need to molt. I'm behind. The weather was so nice, I just wanted to keep these guys around, and now here we are.
Just be sure to not blow them onto your neighbor's yard, or they might tackle
you
and break your ribs.
They might do that. No matter who you are in this world, you are never free from the prospect of neighborly feuds about weather. Thankfully, I live on the corner lot of my street, so I only have one neighbor to worry about.
That's true.
So I can just blow the other direction, and it won't be an issue. Hopefully, anyway. But getting right into it, I mentioned the awards, and some of the awards started coming out. They kind of – baseball does this weird thing where they kind of just build up on the awards, and they kind of slowly release out some of them, some of the more the awards like the Gold Gloves that are giving out multiple ones. And then they kind of – almost like a triangular – form of awards, heading to the point of, you know, your MVPs and your Cy Youngs, etc. So with that first wave has come out some very notable Royals, got some awards today, or was it yesterday that they got the awards?
Within the week. They sprinkled these in and it's just like, here's some awards. Oh, okay. I didn't really know.
Yeah.
They did the show for the Gold Gloves, but it's like past the first year or two where a lot of Royals were nominated, it's really not that interesting of a broadcast. So no. I don't pay that much attention. Twitter tells me, you know,
That's how I find out. I'm like, yeah. Oh, I guess that was today. And I guess there were some Royals that won.
Ho-hum.
And there were a couple that won.
Yep.
Alex Gordon won, was it his fourth?
His fifth. His first since 2014, I think.
Yes. But Hosmer, his fourth, correct?
Yep.
He won. So those are the two that won a Gold Glove. Notably, Salvador Perez, who would have won his fifth, and I think most people assumed would win, just eventually, once you win enough Gold Gloves specifically in a row, then it just kind of becomes a reputation thing, and then you just kind of keep winning until you're just objectively that bad that they can't vote for you.
Right.
So it's a little surprising because Salvador Perez, you know, it's not like he had a spectacular season defensively, but it was pretty on par with what you'd expect, but he didn't win. So that's notable for – maybe not in a positive way, but kind of interesting that he didn't take that home for the fifth time. But Alex Gordon, Eric Hosmer did. Alex Gordon perhaps the shining light in an otherwise season full of darkness. And Eric Hosmer, of course, getting the Gold Glove, which only gives him additional leverage as he comes into free agency to possibly negotiate a big-time contract for him. And for Hosmer's sake as well, something that gives him even more negotiating leverage would be the Silver Slugger Award that Eric Hosmer won, believe it or not. So there we are for that. And so now Eric Hosmer, not only he's just got a good reputation, you know, he's just on reputation alone, and after the season he had, he was going into free agency as one of the marquee guys, but you know, I mean, you really look at his resume and you're looking at a guy who he's an all-star, he's a World Series champion, he's an all-star game MVP, he's a four-time Gold Glove winner, and now he's got a Silver Slugger he can throw on that. I mean, that's a pretty good little resume there to go on the fact that he is also, in fact, really good. So, you know, that's just another one of those things that is going to add to the intrigue for the Hosmer contract negotiations that will surely be interesting.
He's going to have a pretty full binder when they go into those negotiations.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
it's loaded. It'll be the funniest, and it's always funny, too, because you know, you constantly go back and forth. We've talked about it before. No need to rehash the whole thing, but you know, with the stat guys versus the scout guy, the eye test guys, those types of things, and those arguments that continue to go back and forth and will into eternity. But there'll be whoever the team where Hosmer is negotiating with, whatever the rumors come out. Oh, the Yankees are negotiating with Hosmer, the Angels, whoever. It'll be, you know, inevitably half of their fan base will be, oh, that's really good. He's really good. He's great at defense. He's won four Gold Gloves. And then the other half of that fan base will come out. He's not as good as it thinks. Gold Gloves are meaningless, et cetera, et cetera. And round we go.
Hooray.
Hooray. It'll be quite fun. But at least it'll be fun to see another fan base deal with it.
Yeah. I can't wait till they figure out that he hits the ball on the ground 55% of the time.
Yeah, whatever. Like, whatever.
What?
Whichever fan base either signs him or is heavily negotiating for him, one of those people who is in our similar position, it does a podcast, blog site, whatever for that fan base, is going to find that information out. I mean, not that it's secret or anything, but is going to, like, most people probably don't look at the ground ball rates of random first basemen on other teams. So when it's your team negotiating with an Eric Hosmer, you're going to look at everything more closely, and someone's going to see that and start beating that drum to the fan base. And then, you know, it's some people are going to be like, oh my God, this is right. Don't overpay for Hosmer. And everyone else is going to be like, you guys are idiots. Have you even watched him play? And oh man, I just hope I'm following the appropriate Twitter fans or the appropriate fans on Twitter to actually see this unfold, because it's going to happen and it's going to be hilarious.
That's kind of a perverse joy in other people learning that,
right?
that some of the things that we've picked up by following.
Yeah.
I mean, we've watched Eric Hosmer hit for 7 years now. I mean, it's like we kind of get that sense. You can almost get that feeling when he's going to start getting hot and also when he's starting to kind of crater. So I'm kind of with you, I guess. It's kind of going to be interesting to see how these fan bases react with these guys, where they're doing stuff that we see and are used to, but they may not see frequently enough to pick up on. And to see them kind of come to the realizations that, they're not always that good. That'll be interesting.
Yes. Yes, it will definitely be interesting.
Yeah.
Another interesting one that I've said is the free agency I'm most interested in is another person similar to Salvador Perez, notable for the fact that he did not win a Gold Glove, would be Lorenzo Cain. And I only say it's notable because, you know, I don't think many people thought he would win this year with someone like Byron Buxton being a huge almost shoo-in, but just lots of times in our history we've seen people win Gold Gloves who don't necessarily deserve them. Maybe Eric Hosmer? I don't know. Maybe Salvador Perez. I don't know.
Or at least those guys who have been nominated a bunch of times and never end up winning one. I mean, you kind of see it as kind of the Leonardo DiCaprio kind of thing, or the
Scorsese,
where you're winning not necessarily for that particular year's project.
Precisely. That's what
you're winning it for something else, which in Kane's case, he certainly should have won a Gold Glove up to this point. From now, he's kind of screwed because there's a lot of really good center fielders and they're younger than he is. So it's going to be tougher.
Yeah. Them's the breaks, I suppose. But, you know, we mentioned those guys. And then the other, finally, the award that we heard is that was revealed, Mike Moustakas winning Comeback Player of the Year, which is one of those bittersweet awards because it's most notable for the fact that you either had to really stink the year before or you had to be injured the year before and miss almost the entire season. So I guess on the fortunate side of if it has to be one of those two things, Moose was missed the whole season because he was injured, you know, whereas next year, you know, cause it doesn't have to be injury, right?
No,
next year, someone like Gordon,
whatever,
or if Gordon has a 2011. Yeah. I mean, if Alex Gordon has a season like 2011 next year, he would easily win Comeback Player of the Year. So, but it would mean that he sucked really hard in 2017, which he in fact did. So, offensively, I should say, since he did win a Gold Glove. So with Mike Moustakas, you know, I guess the fortunate side of that is that he was only injured, and it wasn't just that he was really bad. But he did win Comeback Player of the Year, which is, again, kind of bittersweet, only because he missed the whole season. Maybe he could have broken Balboni's record in 2016. We'll never know. But he did win Comeback Player of the Year, which is really cool. You know, so good for him. You know, it's always nice to be recognized that, hey, you know, it's difficult to come back from an ACL tear. And, you know, it's something that doesn't happen a ton in baseball. So it's, you know, it's if you're in football – and you are somebody who tears your ACL, there's going to be probably 3-4 players on your team that have had that injury, and you can talk to them and they can kind of talk you through how it's going to happen, what it's going to feel like, what it's going to be like. I don't recall anybody off the top of my head that tore their ACL. I know it's happened in baseball, but I don't recall anybody off the top of my head that's happened specifically recently, and definitely not on the Royals. So, you know, it's a little bit of a different animal in baseball, and it's probably harder for Moose to kind of have that base point of, you know, who's going to – can anybody tell me how this is going to go, what I need to work on, what's going to be hardest when I come back, et cetera. And he was able to come back and have a very, very productive season. And he was recognized for that, so that's cool. But interesting thread between all these not interesting thread, but just a nice little thread between all these players with the exception of Gordon is that we found out officially today on top of the awards – or not today, sorry, this week on top of the awards – that Mike Moustakas, Lorenzo Cain, and Eric Hosmer were, as we predicted, all offered qualifying offers. That's not to say that we're great prognosticators. It wasn't that hard to predict
nope.
Those three were going to happen. But, you know, we kind of assumed all along they'd be offered QOs. Some people were saying, people like Lorenzo Cain or somebody, maybe you shouldn't offer him one or whatever. But they were all three offered, and all indications are that they will be turned down as those three players pursue free agency. So it'll be kind of interesting to see where they go. So it's official now, and then if they sign somewhere else, and we kind of went over all the QO stuff last week, so if you'd like a little bit more detail on how the qualifying offers work and the compensation provided to the Royals, et cetera, you can go back and listen to last week's episode if you haven't already. But, you know, assuming those players –
the qualifying offer
and you. How to understand the most complicated procedure in sports. So, but – so whatever the, you know, wherever those players sign and for how much they sign for, the Royals are going to get some compensation for it. The Royals come June, when the 2018 draft happens, the Royals are going to have a lot of things, a lot of draft picks to kind of play around with. And, it's not as advantageous as it is in, say, football, where you can use a lot of draft picks to, like, trade up or make some big blockbuster trades for players or something. But it is advantageous in the sense that it allows the Royals, if they're so inclined, to take some chances that maybe they otherwise wouldn't. You know, if you're if the Royals, I mean, what are the Royals' pick is going to be next year? What's do we know what the final
18th?
Okay, so I mean, if they're at pick 18, and you know, there's a somebody who is maybe a younger high school player who's got a high upside, but maybe take a while to develop, but they know is not going to be there for another round or two, but maybe a little bit higher than he would be slotted otherwise. Maybe you take a chance on him knowing, okay, in 30 picks, we have another pick, so we could take a safer pick there. And then our next two picks can be really safe or something. And then you can kind of take some chances, and that's where you can start filling in or start trying to fit in picks like the Will Myers pick from when the Royals drafted him, where somebody who most people assume is going to go to college or something like that, you can say, hey, we're going to make a play for this guy. We're going to draft his rights anyway. We're going to try and convince him to come play baseball for us. And you know, so it gives that kind of freedom, which is nice. But
plus they get extra draft pool money with each pick that they add.
Yes.
And in the there were only 9 players who were offered the qualifying offer. So most of those are going to be
– right.
It's, you know, ever since – it does seem low, but it's pretty consistent with what has happened year by year since they've had this system, just because the old system was so ridiculous, where you would have basically an entire round that was just compensation picks. Now it's a lot smaller, and really there's only 6 teams that are going to be subject to getting any kind of compensation, and I think most will probably get $50 million, but there's a chance that some may not. But the Royals, all 3 of these guys, they stand to be, $50 million plus signings. And really, I guess when it comes down to it, some of the teams are like the Cubs, the Indians, and others who don't necessarily get the revenue sharing that then turns into allowing them to get that post first round pick instead of the pre-third round pick. So the Royals basically are going to be in a position where they're probably going to have like 4 of the top 4, it'd be like 5 of the top 40 picks or so when you figure in their own draft pick at 18, 3 qualifying offer compensation picks, and then the competitive balance pick that they're going to have at round A, which is I think 5 teams will get this year. So you know, 30 teams plus maybe, let's say, 5 first-round picks from qualifying offers and then 5 picks for the competitive balance. I mean, that's pretty solid for a team that's looking to rebuild. So
yes.
They're in a pretty good position. And we talked about, you know, the kind of the round-by-round money that might be involved there on the qualifying offer show. So hop back and check that out for more details.
So when you heard the news about the, you got your little thoughts out, but when you heard about all the awards, kind of what were your thoughts on those? Were you surprised that Salvador Perez didn't, again, my surprise wasn't necessarily as much that, oh, he really deserved it, but just that I thought he would win if for no other reason than reputation. Were you kind of surprised as well, or did you think that had kind of worn off?
I was surprised about Sal. I wasn't too surprised about Gordon because I thought he had one of his better defensive seasons, just compared to especially his more recent ones. But
it felt watered down, I think, just because of his offensive poorness.
With Sal, I think a big chunk of it is that he just didn't throw out as many base runners. And in a lot of cases, it's not really his fault. I mean, he had a lot of starts with Jason Hamill and some with Chris Young early on, and like none of those guys are really all that good at holding base runners. Ian Kennedy's not that great at it. Duffy's pretty good. Vargas has been pretty good, but you know, there's a certain point where there are some pitchers that are just going to give up stolen bases, and you could have, you know, literally the best catcher ever back there, and it's not going to matter because, you know, ball players are smart, coaches are smart, and they know which guys to run on, and they know how to key on when to run on them. And, you know, if that gives them that extra little, you know, maybe an extra step on their lead and an extra jump, it's all she wrote. I mean, there's not much you can do about it if the guy's already halfway down the line before you're out of your crouch. And that happened way too often for Sal. You know, he didn't have, like, that standout kind of defensive season, but I think he was good enough to win it, especially since he was good enough to get nominated. And in a lot of cases, like you said, reputation is pretty much half the battle in a lot of cases. Derek Jeter won a bunch of gold gloves, and he certainly didn't deserve them most of the time. So I think, you know, they're nice. Gold gloves are nice. I don't know that they always award the best defensive player. I think sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So I was kind of indifferent. I was upset Kane didn't get it, but I understand because Byron Buxton is very good at what he does. I was more surprised, really, about Hosmer winning one because he didn't win one last year. And statistically, metrics don't like him defensively. And a lot of people don't like him just with the eye test either. So I think that's definitely a reputation thing. I think it's unfair for the most part. I think he's pretty good, but he does have his moments where he thinks he can get to a ball that he doesn't or sometimes does and there's still no play. So, you know, it's one of those things. You just kind of have to take the grain of salt with the award.
Yes.
Silver Slugger, okay, fine. I don't get that. He had a good year. But I wouldn't sit here and say that, you know, he's the best hitting first baseman in the league. It doesn't really fit for me, but okay.
I guess, does that go strictly by batting average, or is it?
I don't even know what criteria they use.
It was batting average.
It might be. That might be it. Let's see. It could be that simple. And if that's
he
tied for third
sense.
He did tie for third place in the American League.
Okay, the Silver Slugger Award is awarded annually to the best offensive player at each position, American League, as determined by the coaches and managers of Major League Baseball. So no, it is not just based on an objective. Let's see.
Maybe they just went to the stats page and hit sort by batting.
Yes, this is from the Wikipedia page on the award. These voters consider several offensive categories in selecting the winners, including batting average, slugging percentage, and on-base percentage. Interesting. I thought it was an objective, just like, well, here you go. Because Billy Butler won. Was it 2012 he won?
Should have been. If he was going to win any year, that would be the one to do it.
Let's see here.
I was going to say maybe 2014 just because I remember the Royals had a good year, but no, Butler hit 9 home runs that year. It's not great at all.
Yeah, Silver Slugger 2012 and the Edgar Martinez Award in 2012.
All right.
So
it's a good year for him. So
yeah, but anyway, so that makes it, makes it more questionable since it's not a completely objective thing. It's strange.
I mean, that's the thing that's going to get Hosmer a lot of money is that he's just got that sparkling reputation with so many other teams that, like, he's just a ball player and whatever faults you can definitely tell, a lot of guys probably going to overlook him just because he seems like he's a good player. And he is, but he's not, like, the superstar that we thought he would turn into, or at least not yet. Maybe over the next 5 years we'll see that change, but... to this point, you know, he's been pretty good half the time and pretty bleh the other half, which is another thing those teams that are tracking him this offseason will learn. So,
yes,
congratulations to them.
Congrats to them.
Why is he good every odd year? I don't know. It's what he does.
Yep. Why does he disappear for months at a time?
I don't know.
Kind of his thing.
It's just what he does. Get used to it.
Get used to it. So let's
say all this. He's going to re-sign with the Royals now.
I know, right? And then we're going to be like, oh, well, I guess it's us.
Okay.
But just to provide some context here. So by saying this is just in the American League, with Hosmer winning the Silver Slugger Award, is competition, right? We had Jose Abreu of the White Sox, who had 33 home runs and had a 304 average, 354, 552 was his line. Justin Smoke, who had 38 home runs, 270, 355, 529. Logan Morrison, who, I mean, that's starting to, you know, he had 38 home runs, but his 246, 353, 516, I mean, you know, you got Carlos Santana, Joey Gallo, Joe Mauer, Chase Headley, you know, I mean, these are the people that you're giving it to over him. I mean, your main ones, Jose Abreu, Justin Smoke, those are kind of your big ones for the American League that it's tough to outright say he's a better hitter than them. But, I mean, at least when you pull up Fangraphs and you sort by first baseman, the default has Hosmer pull up as the number one.
God bless batting average.
Yes, indeed. And BABIP, as BABIP is very high.
I can see that, yeah.
Looks like Trey Mancini had a higher one, but that's the only one, at least in the top 15, that had a higher BABIP than him. But no other first baseman had a higher WAR. He and Jose Abreu tied with 4.1. So,
whatever that is. I never guessed that.
I wouldn't have either, but but there it is. So anyway, we can move along from that. But when we talk about the qualifying offers and the compensation that the Royals will get and the draft, you know, we're obviously looking towards the future of this organization and how this organization exactly wants to proceed, because they're kind of in that sort of weird ground. It's definitely – next year is going to definitely be – well, there's two ways to go. And we've talked about this before, but you can go for the full scale 97-2003 Marlins approach, just tear it all down, rebuild from the ground up. So they'd be shopping Sal this offseason, they'd be shopping Danny Duffy this offseason, they'd be shopping Whit Merrifield this offseason. Any notable player who you think could fetch you anything, you send them out there and see who are, if there are any takers. Or you say, okay, we're keeping all these players. We're going to try and sign a couple free agents that maybe aren't blockbuster deals but can help the team stay relevant, stay competitive, be in that 75 to 85 win range for the next couple of years, try and replenish through the draft, and then come back at this thing one more time. Or not one more time, but try and come back at it again with another window-type opportunity with a lot of cheap young talent. So it appears, based on what we know, with no indications that they're trying to shop Sal or Duffy or Gordon or whoever else, and Ian Kennedy, those players are all going to be back next year. Ian Kennedy decided not to opt out of his contract, so he's going to be a shocker, right? Almost as much of a shocker as giving Hosmer a qualifying offer. But
right.
So those players are all going to be back next year, and we've kind of talked about this before, that they're all very nice pieces to a team, and not only with those players, but the other ones as well, the Bonifacios and Whit Merrifields of the world and everything. And Danny Duffy is the one guy you could argue that if he were to take another step forward, and we all know that he can, there's room for that. Whereas some players, like Whit Merrifield, as much as I like him as a player, I think this year he's topped out this year. And that's nothing wrong with that at all.
Yeah.
But I think that's as far as what Merrifield's going to go, which is great. If he gives you that for the next 3 or 4 years, absolutely fantastic. Love what Merrifield and this fan base is going to love him. But they already do. But
mostly.
But Danny Duffy, I think, has that ability where, as good as he is now, there's more room to grow there. And even if Danny Duffy gives you what he has the last couple seasons, for the rest of his contract, you're still okay with it. But you're expecting a little bit more because it's possible. That said, so he could be technically the centerpiece of a rotation and a team, but right now what Danny Duffy has shown us for the most part in his career, he's shown the flashes, but for the most part, he's just a solid piece of a rotation, not quite that centerpiece yet, at least in terms of his performance. You could maybe make the same argument about Salvador Perez as well. But point being, it's just a team full of really nice pieces. And as of next year, what we're looking at for next year, and they seem like they can be able to compete, and there's no indication that any of that is going to change. So it seems that that's the route the Royals are going to go. Let's try and stay relevant as much as we can, win 80 to 85 games every year for the next two or three, build up in the draft, and then see if we can make another splash in a few years. So I don't necessarily have the hugest problem with that method, but you know, that's kind of the method they would take. I would probably choose to just go for the full scale rebuild, but that's very hard to sell as an organization. It's not very sexy to sell to the average fan. You know, I mean, the Astros did it and their fans hated it. They hate them.
Look at the TV ratings for Houston in some of those years. It was like 1,000 people would watch, like literally 1,000 people would watch the games on TV.
And
that's in Houston. That's in, you know, the fourth largest city in the country.
Yeah. And I heard, or not heard, but I saw, you know, Kevin Goldstein. We talked about him after Houston won the World Series and how he had been on the show a few times. And back when he was writing for Baseball Prospectus and doing the Up and In podcast, and now he's in Houston's front office. And I still follow him on Twitter, and he doesn't tweet nearly as much anymore because he's in the front office.
He's busy winning things.
Yeah. But after they won, he tweeted, it was the next day, and I saw just kind of a little thread that he had, and he talked about in 2012 when he was hired with the Astros, or I can't remember if it was 2012 or whatever, but what he was referencing was when he'd gotten hired with the Astros, but he hadn't yet made it public. You know, he was in Houston, and he had gone to a bar, and he was seeing that there were some Astros fans there, and he said he remembered talking to them, and they were just dejected, and they were just like, man, it's tough, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And the point being, he saw how hard it was for fans at that time, and that's kind of who he was thinking of now that they had won, and how he's like, I hope those fans are really enjoying it and are glad they stuck around, you know, which was a nice sentiment, but, you know, that's what you have to deal with if you're going to try and do a full-scale rebuild and just tear it all down, you know. So that's not something that's easy to sell, and it's not sexy, and it doesn't bring in ratings, and it doesn't bring in money, and it makes it really tough. And we saw it, the Royals, you know, we dealt with that. It wasn't – the Astros very clearly had a plan, and the Royals for a very long time didn't have that.
No, so no, their tanking was not intentional in the mid-2000s.
So, I mean, you could argue that it was harder for Royals fans, but you know, don't want to go through that again. It's still fresh in the mind. Royals fans are, you know, Kansas City fans in general, you know, a lot of goodwill has been achieved with the World Series victory, but it seems like there's still an essence in Kansas City of just waiting for that other shoe to drop.
Well, so that's tough.
But so as we talk about going towards the future now, it seems like that's the plan. One of the things that actually, before we get into that, just something, a little note. I forgot we meant to go over this. This week, the Royals, they hired a couple new coaches. So I'll kind of just briefly, we can talk about this. And Mike, you had some interesting notes to give on these coaches. But the Royals recently brought in, or they promoted Terry Bradshaw, who
not that one.
No, nope.
Right.
Not the one who loved to have naked time in Failure to Launch with Matthew McConaughey.
Never saw it. Now I'm not gonna.
That was the thing that happened in that movie. So different Terry Bradshaw. He'll be the new hitting coach. And they have also hired Cal Eldridge, who will be the pitching coach. So those are your two new guys. So when the Royals come out and they suck offensively next season, you can blame Terry Bradshaw, and you can make jokes about how he wasn't good at football either if you want.
You could.
Cal Eldridge, there's no famous person with that name, though you could – with the Cal Eldred, you could kind of make a Superman joke in there somehow. Cal Eldred.
Oh, I see it. Yeah. Name. Cal Eldred.
Yeah. Cal, there you go. Even you could put the dread on. There you go. Yeah. Man, you're welcome, Royals fans.
There's your hashtag right there.
If pitching is bad next year, you have us to thank for that hashtag. but yeah. We've gotten some kind of interesting testimonials, or not testimonials, but some interesting anecdotes that we've been able to compile and things. And Mike, you had those all. You want to break those down for
Yeah. So the kind of the cool thing is with Terry Bradshaw, he's been in the Royals organization as a coach since 2000 at various levels. Most notably, he was the hitting coach in Omaha from 2004 to 2008. And then he was the hitting coach in Northwest Arkansas from 2009 to 2012. You'll notice that some of those years overlap with some guys who came up through the system and ended up winning some rings. But even more, you know, in 2006, he was working with Mark Tian. Mark Tian, obviously, you know, had been this marquee, this key figure in the Carlos Beltran trade and was going to be the third baseman of the future and struggled, and then they sent him down to the minors. Well, you know, when he came back, he had a great second half. Really inspired a lot of people to think that he was, you know, turning it on, he was going to be a future star. Didn't work out that way, but they still got that kind of, you know, resurgence from him. Mark Tian ended up tweeting... this is after an exchange between Dave Lesky, Brian McGinnon, and Cody Tapp from 810. Mark Tian said, "I'd loved Terry as a hitting coach. If he could make me a beast, he can help plenty of the current Royals. He's also a great guy and the type of person you want associated with the team you cheer for." So that's pretty good good praise for Tian, who worked closely with him.
Yes.
You know, he's also – Bradshaw's also been the minor league hitting coordinator. He took over in 2013 after Jack Maloof had been hired. Jack Maloof obviously was the hitting coach at the beginning of 2013, and he didn't make it through the end of May because the Royals were hitting terribly, and then hired George Brett as the hitting coach, who lasted about 7 weeks. And then Pedro Grifol took over as the lead hitting coach the rest of the way until he in turn was fired – the next May, or not fired, he was demoted to, well, he was reassigned to catching coach and now has been reassigned also as catching coach and quality control coach, which I don't know what that is. Whatever. So the Royals kind of went through hitting coaches like Spinal Tap drummers for a while there. And
that's maybe the best analogy.
I mean, that's just kind of what it is. They just, oh, that was the running joke. It was like, if a guy got past May, there you go. You're solid. And Dale Swain has been the hitting coach for a while. He will be the bench coach now. But another player that Bradshaw worked with is Lane Adams. And Lane Adams has lately been someone who was kind of more of a defense and speed guy coming up with the Royals, and was used almost exclusively as a pinch runner in 2014 in September. But he's really kind of turned it on. He's in the Braves system now and got a look late in the year last season. It's funny that Lane Adams beat Bubba Starling to the majors by a lot. But Lane Adams sings his praises as well, that you know, that Bradshaw was really kind of a shift from an older philosophy that the Royals had, where, you know, really trying to hit low line drives. There's an anecdotal urban legend of a drill where you would try to hit it under a netting. So it was like a lot of lack of loft that the Royals were trying to train into their players, which kind of makes
sense. For some reason.
Yeah, when you kind of watch how they hit for a while, you kind of see how that worked out. Bradshaw is kind of shifted from that, so he's got a little bit more of that new school feel. So you know, he's going to be maybe a little bit more open to different things. Plus, you figure, you know, this is going to be a team with some younger players, some guys like Whit Merrifield and Jorge Bonifacio and Raul Mondesi and Chesler Cuthbert and probably Hunter Dozier or Ryan O'Hearn, or you know, guys like that who Bradshaw's worked with them, and so he's going to be bringing a lot of experience with some of those guys with him to this major league job. So that's going to be interesting to kind of see how that young group adjusts to a change in hitting coach and someone they're familiar with. Sounds like just he's somebody who, you know, a lot of players really like working with. So hopefully that's something good. There's also a story, a brief anecdote I saw, that he worked with Paulo Orlando a lot in Northwest Arkansas, and we saw Orlando develop and become a big leaguer and kind of a a nice fill-in, if not a regular. So, you know, that's another player to kind of watch to see how they react. With Eldred, I think this kind of gets more into the kind of discussion that they had, that Dayton Moore had, when they announced that Dave Island wasn't returning. And a couple things that he said were geared more towards development of pitchers. Obviously, we've seen the Royals over the years. They haven't developed a lot of good starting pitchers. They've developed some pretty good bullpen pitchers. But, you know, other than Danny Duffy and Yordano Ventura, and, you know, I guess if you wanted to count them, like Mike Montgomery and Brandon Finnegan and whatnot, you know, not a lot of guys have come up through the system that ended up landing solid jobs as big league starters or key pitchers on a staff. And the Royals have had to go out and get Jason Vargas and Ian Kennedy and Jason Hamill and Chris Young, et cetera, et cetera. And so now Eldred comes from he spent 3 years in the Cardinals organization where he was kind of a assistant to the GM, kind of a roving coach. But they also, like, unofficially, he was more of like a life skills coach is how they referred to him a couple times. Which I think that will lend itself to working with some of these younger players, some of these guys who maybe are coming up and are hitting some resistance and hitting some failure for the first time, or at least like big time failure, big time pressure. Maybe that will help on top of his technical expertise. You know, I haven't really heard anything about his general philosophy. But, you know, he himself was someone who could throw pretty hard when he was a pitcher in the big leagues, battled some injuries, ended up, you know, kind of finding a way to stick. And I think that kind of tends to work okay for a pitching coach and any kind of coach, really, is the guy who got the most out of their talent and found a way to hang on. So if that is something that he can lend towards the younger pitchers, you know, I think that'll be good. Hopefully he has kind of the same eye as Dave Island had for some of the smaller mechanical things. We'll see. I'm going to keep looking out for other stories about what he's done with the Cardinals organization to see if maybe I can glean something else. It's probably going to have to be something, you know, maybe towards spring training we hear a little bit more or as other features pop up. So we'll certainly share those. Those are the two main coaching changes. I mean, Mitch Meyer took over at first base last year for Rusty Kuntz. He will continue as the first base coach. Mike Gerschle will be back. Pedro Grifol, like we said, is going to be quality control coach. I have no idea what that means. I'm really interested to find out what that means.
Well, he's going to control the quality.
Oh, okay.
What that means.
Okay.
I don't know if you saw the name of the coach, but that's what he's going to do.
Okay, great. I wonder what he's – yeah.
No, there was – they have that in football too. Nobody knows what the hell they do. But in football, it's usually like, okay, we think this kid is a future in coaching, and it's somebody young, so we're going to keep them around.
We're going to keep paying
them.
Them
this BS title so that nobody else steals them, you know?
Right.
And maybe they do one thing really well, but they need to develop other parts of their coaching repertoire, if you will, and they don't want to put too much pressure on them, et cetera. But Pedro Grifol's been around for a while. He's been around the organization for a while.
Yeah.
So maybe it's different in baseball than football. But, yeah, that's a weird one.
I don't know. The other interesting one is Vance Wilson is going to be the bullpen coach. Now, Vance Wilson has been with the Royals organization since 2010. He started managing in – A-ball, low A for Kane County when they were a Royals affiliate. He moved on to Wilmington for a couple of years. He was in Northwest Arkansas for 3 or 4 years. One of those kind of like names that everybody kind of knows is going to be a manager someday. Interesting that he didn't get like a bump to Omaha. But in Omaha, you've got Brian Poldberg, and Poldberg has been in the Royals organization forever. And I don't think he has any aims of – I mean, I think he would like to go into the big leagues, but I don't think it's one of those things that he has to have. And so I don't think that they wanted to move Wilson up to Omaha to displace Poldberg. So they made him bullpen coach. Feels to me like this is them giving him a chance to be around a big league club for a full year. And then we'll see. I don't know if that's a precursor to him succeeding Ned Yost or if that means that he'll be bench coach. Maybe he'll be quality control coach next year. I don't know. But he's going to be one of those guys that even more than Grifol, probably the Royals wanted to get him some opportunity in the big league so that he's around this team. Because I do think that he's probably got a really good chance of being a future manager for this team. And if not the Royals, he's going to get a job somewhere as a manager. It's kind of been his destiny for the last, 4 years or so. People knew Vance Wilson's going to be a manager in the big league someday. So the Royals, that's what it seems like to me. Haven't seen them actually say anything to that effect, but it sure seems like this is them not wanting to just jump him to Omaha because that's the next step. This is, let's put him in the middle of it and see, what happens and how he kind of works with this team and goes from there. So that was interesting. That was an interesting name to see pop up in that position. So a lot of changes, but, there's a lot of changes with the roster too. So, it kind of goes hand in hand, I suppose.
Absolutely. So now, as that kind of solidifies the coaching staff as we move forward, and we've talked about the qualifying offers and all that, we'll talk about something that we kind of put to bed. We've kind of been just kind of mentioning it as something that's hanging out there. And last week, we actually mentioned, and we're talking about Dayton Moore going to Atlanta and how he was denied the right to speak to Atlanta about the position, let alone take it from Dan Glass. Who was it formally? Did they say, was it David Glass that did it, or was it Dan Glass that I can't remember.
I think it was David Glass.
Yeah. So, but the reason I conflated the two is, now there's kind of talk that it might have been something that Dan Glass was pushing for, and now there's talk of a rift between Dayton Moore and the Glasses and how they haven't spoken since that news came down about not being allowed to talk to the Braves about this open GM position. So it's really kind of weird. Again, we just kind of touched on it briefly last week, and I think our kind of final standpoint on it was that we just anticipated it would kind of go away and it would be a nothing thing, but now it's kind of cropped up again. And then if you go to BP Kansas City as well, Craig Brown has written an article about it where he kind of goes into a little bit more detail, and he talks about the how everything works between David Glass, Dan Glass, Dayton Moore, how the relationship has been, and kind of what the rumors are and what they mean going forward. So he's got a little bit he's got some good information, and it's definitely worth going to read there. We're not going to rehash the whole article. We'll just kind of give our takes on it, on the situation. Excuse me. So it's really kind of strange how this has developed, because when we've discussed it before, we had the impression that the Glasses were – David Glass was kind of being a fall guy almost for Dayton Moore, where, he David Glass and Dayton Moore have had such a great, very tight, very good relationship for such a very long time, and the idea that it would fall apart now seems kind of weird. So we thought maybe Dayton Moore knew he didn't want to accept the Atlanta job, but he didn't want to talk to him and be offered it and then have to say no. So the easy way to avoid that is to tell your boss, hey, can you make it public that you're not allowing me to do this, so that way I don't have to deal with it? And Dayton Glass was going to kind of quote-unquote fall on the sword for him, if you will, which seems like, based on their relationship, seemed like a very logical, very reasonable thing that would occur. But then here we are, and a week later, and now all this stuff is coming out about this possible rift, and there's been no communication between the two, and everything keeps getting fuzzy. And the whole thing that's hanging out here this whole time is, while all this stuff is going on, there's been – the Braves have not hired a new person for their front office, be it GM or otherwise. And there hasn't really been I haven't seen – I've been kind of busy with work and with the kid lately. So I, admittedly, this week I haven't been able to follow the world of baseball news as much.
You haven't been following the Atlanta Braves?
Yeah, right. But, I mean, have you heard anything? Because I haven't heard anything about them and who they're interviewing or who they're looking at. That's just kind of in limbo for them. And I don't know if they're waiting until – until everything comes down in terms of what possible punishments they have, or you know, everything with this kind of weird situation with their previous GM. So that's a weird scenario as well. But all the while, that's hanging out there. So now you've got Dayton Moore, who obviously he's got ties to both the Royals and the Braves. He's been forbidden from his own – the owners, his boss – to be able to talk to the Braves, and now they're not talking to each other, presumably because of this this forbidding that was carried down. And it just kind of put everything in this weird sort of space. You know, the team needs to be moving forward. They've got these qualifying offers, they've got free agency, you know, they've got all these things that they need to be doing in the off season, and all this is going on, and then the Atlanta Braves in the background. And I mean, the only possible scenario from here, if something, you know, sort of cataclysmic, if you will, were to happen for the organization, it would be Dayton Moore would essentially just have to quit and then go to the Braves. But the idea being, of course, if he quits, if he can't talk to the Braves first, if he quits, he has to be certain he's going to get that job. Otherwise, he's out of a job. So, and then you've got to worry about the repercussions of, I don't know what his contract terms are, but, you know, if he quits and goes to the Braves, then the Royals could ask for repercussions from that, from Dayton Moore, a buyout. I'm sure that would be something that the Braves would probably help out with, and he, you know, wouldn't be a huge concern. And I don't know how all that stuff works with how the MLB works. You know, maybe if Dayton Moore just quits and goes right to the Braves, maybe that forces the Braves to give the Royals compensation. I don't know that I've seen a situation like that that's occurred. So I'm not sure what happens, but I mean, it just, the whole thing is just weird now. Is it, a couple weeks ago, we were certain that it was just a nothing thing. Dayton Moore was 90% going to stay. Everything was going to be fine. And we were just going to keep moving forward. But now it just feels so much weirder, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's – I mean, a couple weeks ago, I was sitting here thinking, oh, this is nothing. They're going to hire someone. It's going to go, you know, no – you know, it's a story because it's Dayton Moore and it's Atlanta. And then, you know, I would have said probably 2 weeks ago, I would probably have said 80% chance Dayton Moore is staying. I would still say he's probably going to stay, but I would probably say it's maybe more like a 60-40 just because if there is this – you know, miscommunication within the front office or interference from Dan Glass or who knows what's going on. Well, I mean, Dayton Moore knows that he can hop right over to this job in Atlanta. You know, if they're going to give him basically the red carpet to walk through, it's something he would have to think to explore. And, you know, it's not as concrete and it's not going away. And, you know, really, if the Braves are looking to fill a president of baseball ops position and not just a general manager operation, you know, that's there's a limited pool of candidates for that. I mean, GMs, you see new GMs all the time, but those presidents of baseball ops, those are guys who have been in there, who have been GMs before, and there's just not a lot of those that are available or that teams want to get. I mean, like, Steve Phillips isn't getting those jobs. He's doing TV. So there's a reason for that. It's because teams don't want to bring Steve Phillips back. He's fine on TV, I guess. But like, Dayton Moore is going to be a highly coveted person in that kind of spot. He's got sparkling reputation. And for the Braves, coming off of some, you know, signing controversies, that's kind of what you want. He's you know, cut his teeth in their scouting department and as an executive. So that's another thing that kind of fits the profile. I mean, Mark Bowman who covers the Braves for MLB.com says he's perfect. He's a perfect fit and that Atlanta is just willing to wait. And, you know, maybe it'll pick up once some of those penalties for those bad signings maybe once those are handed down, it'll change the equation. But, yeah, I mean, if there is some weirdness in the front office in Kansas City, I could see why Dayton Moore would be maybe more considering of that job if it means that he's getting out of a situation where there's going to be interference or where things are just off kilter, you know, especially in the face of another rebuild, whereas Atlanta has some pretty decent prospects coming up and probably a better shot at contending quicker than the Royals might. Certainly an easier spot to be in, considering that he doesn't have to completely rebuild a farm system and doesn't have to completely reload a farm system and replace, you know, three basically Kansas City iconic players. So it's,
and let's be honest here, you know, you can't talk to the Braves in this context, is that you can't talk to them formally. You know, Dayton Moore has people that he knows. He has his agent, who I'm not sure who his agent is, but you know, there are certainly ways to, you know, without going and sitting down at Capitol Grill with the rest of the Atlanta Braves, you know, with the Atlanta Braves owner or whoever.
That would
be
such a baseball executive thing to do.
Right?
Capitol Grill.
But, I mean, as opposed to doing that, yeah, they're khakis and a blazer, a navy blue.
Right.
With the gold buttons. But instead of doing that, or actually with Dayton Moore, it would be a windbreaker, even inside. But yeah. You know, with the outside of doing that, you know, there's certainly tons of back channels that can be made where, you know, if he needs assurance from the Braves that if he were to quit, would the Braves give him that job? He could get it if he really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dayton Moore, I truly believe, is not the kind of guy who would necessarily make too much of a habit of going down back channels and doing things like that, especially given the fact that, you know, the Braves are now in trouble for all the shady shit that they did. The idea of doing more shady stuff just to get him on board is probably not where you want to start off this thing. Right. But it's possible, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, and the fact that it doesn't go away. I mean, it would be just on the other side of it, it'd be just as easy for him to back channel a firm no and let them move on. If yes. There was really no interest in it, I mean, he could definitely, you know, put the end to that. So I don't know. Maybe there's more fire here than just smoke. It's kind of interesting to see. You mentioned that you were not really sure on his contract. The terms aren't completely disclosed. I think there's 1 or 2 years left on his deal. You'll remember the Cubs got Theo Epstein from Boston, and he was still under contract. So they did have to give up a couple of minor league pitchers as some compensation. I don't think they really did anything in the big leagues, but there was at least some kind of, you know, compensation, reparation, payment, whatever, for that kind of hiring. So I don't know if it would work if Dayton Moore were to resign and then go somewhere else, but I'm sure it would probably be about the same thing. There would probably be some kind of request or motion from the Royals to get something like that, just because you just lost your GM out from under yourself. I think they would be a little upset and want something in return since he was still under contract. It would make sense. So I don't know what's going to happen. By this time next week, he might buy the Braves. Who knows? Which could be all kinds of places with this story. So it keeps developing, and it hasn't gone away in a month. So I guess it's a thing. It's something to kind of keep an eye on.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm very much more interested now than I was a couple weeks ago. But, man, I mean, how many times have we said on this show just in the last few weeks, ever since that Braves thing came up, because I was instantly – when everything came down about the Braves, that was instantly Dayton Moore's name was the first one to get brought up. Mm-hmm. And really, that's the only one that's been brought up since. And it, like you said, it just won't go away. So
there's the question of, would that necessarily be a bad thing? I mean, Dayton Moore brought the parade here, yes. And he did bring in all those prospects in 2011 and 2012 and brought them up and everything. But we've expressed our frustrations plenty about positions, approaches, outlooks, philosophies, things like that. Maybe it wouldn't hurt to bring someone new in if it came to that. I'm sentimental. I have trouble like saying, yeah, he sucks, but let's keep, you know, I would rather he stay. Devil, you know, and I think he's fine. I think, you know, people overblow some of his decisions. He's had some rough luck in the past couple of off seasons. But you know, I think generally I would say, I'm fine sticking with him and seeing what happens. But if he left, I don't think it'd be like, you know, the Royals would find somebody and it would probably work out. So there might be a shift in maybe the Royals, who have never, ever taken walks. I think they have one season where they've walked more than the league average in their existence.
Yeah.
That maybe that's something that you know, is reinforced throughout the system that, hey, let's be more patient. Let's be more disciplined. Let's have better plate presence. I don't know. Well, that could be something. Maybe something in pitching development changes and the Royals are waiting for that person to unlock all of those things. I don't know. But at the same time, I would rather the Royals not be in this chaos of having to find a GM and basically, you know, start everything over and kind of midstream while you're trying to bring up other prospects. So it's interesting. We'll have to see what happens in the next week because there's probably going to be another development somewhere.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sentimental the way you are, but I also get excited at the prospect of, you know, just because, you know, we talk about the average fan and how, you know, you and I versus the average fan just in town, you know, we're really invested. Obviously, we do a weekly podcast, and so we're, you know, we're deep into a lot of different things that maybe the casual fan, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you don't have to be one type of fan or the other, but there's a lot of fans that don't go as deep into the organization as we do and don't look at things like we just know nothing wrong with that. But just coming from that perspective, I can kind of get excited sometimes about, you know, a new regime, a new era, a new, new direction, you know, new philosophies, you know, oh, who are they going to bring as the manager? How are they going to draft? Are they going to go for, you know, a lot of college talent that's ready sooner? Are they going to go for a lot of high school talent and trying to develop? And how do they handle all these things? And, you know, that kind of stuff is interesting to me. I'm very interested in a lot of the philosophy of baseball behind drafting strategy and hitting philosophy and pitching philosophy and all that kind of thing. So, you know, like you said, devil, you know, we know what Dayton Moore is. We know what he's about. And I'm okay with it. So, you know, if he's here, that's great because he's shown what he can do. But to your point, excuse me, as well, you know, he has also kind of mentioned how the rebuild is very taxing on him. I mean, if you think about him coming in 2006 and winning in 2015, it's a 10-year journey just to win, and it's been 2 years removed from that. So if it goes, you know, something somewhere close to how it did previously, and if you're looking at another, say it's sped up a little bit more just because they have they're starting from a better place than they were, you know, say it's still 5 to 7 years, you know, does he have the capacity to, or does he have the desire to handle that, to go through that again? And he's actually made some public statements about he doesn't know if he himself has the desire to go through another rebuild like that. So it'll be interesting to see. I'm sorry.
You gonna live?
I have been kind of battling this chest cold, you know, where it just
sits there.
Nothing huge, but yeah, it just sits there. It feels like that one where you just want to clear your throat and you think it'll be gone and it won't. But so it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out the next, I would think in the next couple of weeks. This should get resolved one way or the other, because I doubt the Braves want to go that long without having a essentially rudderless front office. Mm-hmm. So we'll kind of see on that front. sorry, I think we should end the show on that.
Yes,
my voice seems like it's about to get destroyed here. So we'll end there. Thank you all so much for listening. Be sure to visit our sponsors, Kelly's Westport Inn. As always, go there. Have a fantastic time right in the heart of Westport. Be sure to go and go to BP Kansas City. We're pumping out tons of content. We've got what we mentioned, kind of what we talked to piggyback off of a little bit, Craig Brown's article about the Moore Glass situation. So if you want to hear a little bit more on that and hear Craig's take on it, definitely go and check that out. And then David Leske posted an article today about kind of the futility of posting projections for the 2018 season in November of 2017, especially when we don't even know what the full 25-man roster is going to look like on opening day. So I don't know that it needs to be said that that's an exercise in futility, but if it does need to be said, David Leske is the person to say it. So definitely go and check that out. And we got a bunch of other articles, of course, on there. We'll continue to pump out content all off season, just as we will continue to be here with the podcasts all off season. So thank you all so much for listening. Appreciate it. Couldn't do it without you. Be sure to check out our sponsors and be sure to come back next week. We'll talk more. Hopefully we'll have some resolution here to this Moore situation, and it will just be, things will continue to heat up week by week as we get further and further into this off season. So we'll be here to cover it all. Be sure to tune in next week. We'll see you then. And until that time, thank you so much for stopping by. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com.
Every town has a place where elites gather for witty conversations over trendy cocktails. In Kansas City, that place is definitely not Kelly's Westport Inn. From its humble beginnings at the corner of Westport Road and Pennsylvania Avenue, Kelly's Westport Inn has seen it all. Pioneer wagon trains filled with families heading west, Civil War battles, and Major League Baseball championships. Kelly's is born of history and tradition, and we hope you'll allow us to become part of your history and traditions as well. Kelly's Westport Inn, 500 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri.